Hi everyone, this is David Grealish with an editor's note. The show is very late this time, plus it is very long, but that can be a bonus for you. I have split the episode into two parts, so now you get two episodes for the price of one. Sorry it took me so long to edit, but some of that thing, you know, got in the way a bunch of times. You know, what's it called? Oh yeah, my regular life. Why can't I just do this for a living? Anyway, in all seriousness, it's a good show with great discussion. So here's part one, and I'll close the show out regularly in part two.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now.
Welcome, welcome. The Retro Computing Roundtable is back, and this is show 7. This is the show of vintage computer news, views, and auctions with your favorite panelists within the community of computer history and nostalgia. I'm David Grealish, and I am in the greater Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia. Everyone bellied up around the virtual table?
Yes, we're here. We're alive. See.
So we have a newcomer on today's show. It's Matt Wilson. And Matt lives in Hobart, Indiana. And you work in Chicago, you say, Matt. So I guess that's not too far away. How much of a commute is that?
It's about an hour drive each way. So
wow,
it can be brutal. But the traffic is not that bad. So.
And you host the Boring Beige Box podcast, which kind of focuses, I guess, mostly on mid-90s gaming on PCs.
Yeah, it's I can basically say real quick how it started. A couple years ago, I found Earl's RetroBits podcast, and it really inspired me. And I began to focus on – I started a podcast to focus on that kind of later era, the 90s era. And, I did it for a couple years, and I sort of lost interest. And I always, you know – It was something I was interested in, but at the time I just got into other things. I had our first child, me and my wife, and just got really busy. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as things kind of pop it back into your mind, you come across something. Actually, another Jason Scott's documentary, the latest one he did on Text Adventures, kind of got me back into retro computing. So I started the podcast up again.
And it's been good. So, you know, the great thing about history, right, is even if it's old, it's still enjoyable.
It is.
So, all your podcasts are still out there, and if anyone hasn't listened to them, I recommend them. Gives another insight into particularly Matt's sort of time frame. I guess the mid-90s, maybe you were sort of a high schooler and young adult.
Yeah.
Is a time frame?
It was, I think around 91, I really started getting into it. I always had I always had access to computers. I mean, you know, since I was very young, obviously, like with the Apple IIe, but I really got into it learning myself, teaching myself around 90, 91. And that's when I first bought my own system. And that's really when I think when you're young, your brain really absorbs the most information. So, yeah, that's the time I kind of focus on as far as computer history goes.
Yeah, and actually, I guess I'm wrong. It's really more most of what you've done in the podcast is actually kind of early 90s then. Yeah, it's like pre-Windows 95, I guess. And a DOS base.
Yeah, a lot of DOS, based stuff, 386, 486 time frame. And really, I'm trying to explore sort of the early days of the internet and online services, I think, is very interesting before it became really mass market. So.
Right, and you've done some shows on that, and they've been enjoyable. So
thank you.
Thanks a lot for being on.
Thank you.
And next we have Evan Koblenz, and we also have Earl Evans, which we'll get to in a minute. So I guess, Evan and Earl, this is both of yours, your third time on, I think, Evan, right? Fourth?
Third, I believe.
Maybe third? Yeah.
I think third.
Okay. So you guys are becoming regular panelists. So Evan is in Springfield, New Jersey, and is the founder and president of the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, or MARCH.
David, I prefer to think of myself as an irregular panelist.
You're an irregular who's also a panelist.
Right.
Yeah, one of the RCR irregulars.
Right.
So MARCH is organizing, organization behind the Vintage Computer Festival East, which I know we want to talk about regularly because it's coming up. So, in fact, it's going to be on Saturday, May 14th, and Sunday, May 15th at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey. So you've been doing lots of planning for that. I know you recently
The last couple of weeks are really starting to get myself into planning mode.
And you just announced some, I think, workshops and some speakers you've got lined up now, presentations
right.
and such.
Rather talk about those now or later? Or...
Yeah, go ahead now.
Okay, let's see. Actually, you have to open my...
cheat sheet,
yeah. Well, we're working on a panel probably for the second day of the show focused on computer pioneers of our local area, mostly from the mid-70s to mid-80s era. For example, we signed up a guy named Larry Stein, who ran Computer Mart of Island, New Jersey, which was probably the first or second computer store in New Jersey. And Computer Mart, of course, was a big chain. We signed up Roger Amadon, who owned an S-100. I don't know if he owned it, but he was a hire guy at an S-100 company in the Princeton area. Mm-hmm. Called Zitan and TDL, Technical Design Labs, an X. Working on getting John Dilks, who ran the famous Atlantic City 76 show. Working on getting Saul Leibs, who founded the Trending Computer Show. He spoke at our show a couple years ago just by himself. He also founded the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, which is probably the longest running computer user group. Working on getting David All of Creative Computing Magazine. If he comes, it'll be his third time at VCF East. And there was a sixth person, Dick Milberg, who founded PAX, the Philadelphia Area Computer Society.
Wow, sounds great.
Yep. We also have a couple guys we signed up so far from the UNIVAC, Unisys side, and they were, in Pennsylvania, not too far away. They're going to come give a talk. And I mentioned briefly a little while ago, might have been before you were recording, thanks to this guy, Ira, we'll talk about later. He wrote this document, and part of his document mentioned a company called Monroe, Monroe Calculator, which had their Monroe Bot Computer Division, which was an important company in the 50s, and they were also in New Jersey, so we signed up a couple guys who worked there to give a talk, and we're still working on some more as well.
Great. And, of course, I intend to be going, and it looks like I'm going to have two people riding with me, which is fun, and one will be my brother I'm excited about, so...
That's good. Keep the ride interesting. We're also working on a couple of, it's not definite yet, but, we used to have Vince Briel come to every show.
I was going to ask you about him now that he's in California.
He's not going to come now, okay. At least not this year because he just moved. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to either get some kind of replacement or maybe line up a couple of classes, something like, how to bootstrap your DEC mini computer or how to evaluate 8-bit micros or things along those lines. So those are not definite yet, though.
Is there anyone – there's been a number of different guys that have made sort of reproduction and kit, computers and 8-bit mm-hmm. things. But other than Vince, who's still actively doing it, is there anyone else who's kind of still actively doing that? I can't remember the one gentleman's name that did the the RCA one, which I built at the VCA.
Yeah, was that Bob
Time
Armstrong?
Gizmos?
Yeah.
Bob Armstrong. Bob Armstrong,
right.
He's out West Coast, so I don't think Bob would come. But anyway, the short answer is I don't know right now. Vince was one of a kind in many ways. We are trying to get some replacements, at the very least have some classes maybe. And we're also going to either do the building where our new museum is going to be, our expanded museum. We're trying to get some township permits to open up to the public early. If we can't do that, then we'll do some sort of video run-through. Sort of a, alpha look at the new museum we're building.
Great. And if it's okay for me to mention, I know we've discussed this, me and you, and also Bill Degnan, about trying to do this show live from the VCF East. So I know that's in the works.
Absolutely.
And there's no concrete plans how to do it or anything. But I don't see why we could. Worst case scenario as far as when I say live, I mean we could at least do it live there and it's recorded and then upload it. I don't know live streaming or anything.
You could do Ustream.
That'd be cool though. I'd like to do that, but we'll see.
Yeah, our internet access is spotty.
Yeah. So it'll be live, it just may not be live streaming. Okay, well that's really exciting and I'm looking forward to it.
It will happen live when it was recorded.
right. In a live studio audience. Well, thanks a lot for being back. So next we've got Earl, so also a three-timer. You'll have to start a club, like Saturday Night Live.
Five-timers club, yeah.
And Earl's in Portland, Oregon, so he's the early riser on today's program. And he's the host of the Retro Bits podcast. You know what, Earl? And I think yours is the longest-running computer history-related podcast, I'm pretty certain. Wouldn't you say? Think so?
It's possible. I might be neck and neck with the C64 Takeaway.
Okay.
You know, so I don't know. We started about the same time, but yeah, it's been, what, 5.5 years going on 6 here at this point? So,
you know, not to take anything from the C64 Takeaway, but I kind of think of that as a sort of different animal. It's not quite the same type of show, even though it is retro computer related.
Maybe a little bit more narrow in scope.
Yeah, because about 8-bit tunes.
Yeah, fun chip tunes. But yeah, been around for a while trying to actually, it's been fun here being back on a somewhat regular schedule. I got a fun interview lined up for next week that I think folks are going to enjoy. I'm going to keep the details under my hat here until the interview actually happens.
Oh,
but,
man.
sorry, no advance warning.
No little hint?
I'll give you a hint. This gentleman runs two or three really popular reference sites on the internet where magazines and books are scanned with permissions by the author, and it's a really fascinating gentleman who just happens to live in my area. So we'll see if that comes together. But things have been cooking along here for RetroBits lately. Been fun to be back in the saddle.
Yeah, and you're part of a thriving Commodore user group.
A couple actually. If you can believe it, there's actually two in the area, and they are both thriving. Lots of fun projects. In fact, my discretionary time has been focusing quite a bit here on Commodore, VIC-20, Commodore 64, that kind of. I was just in online chat with some folks just this last week using my Commodore 64 and this cool little internet modem called the Comet 64. And I was online and, you know, chatting with other people. It was just like being back in the day.
I haven't heard of that.
We had some internet chat, you know, live, and we're all kind of, just kind of sitting around. I mean, it's kind of funny in a day where you've got Skype and perfect audio fidelity and that kind of thing to be sitting and poking around on a Commodore 64 with chat. But that's what we do, right?
Right.
We're retro.
Is Quantum Link Reloaded? Is that still going?
I'm not sure about that. If it is, I think the activity has died way down at this point. I don't know if that was still accessible. I know they had some issues. What was it with the domain name or something like that? But I could check into that. I haven't been on it for a long time.
Yeah, that blew my mind. That was pretty amazing to see that up and running.
Well, I know where Earl's discussion group is, you know, for RetroBits. Yeah, the discussion board or whatever, petsky.com, right? Or also if you go back to the general area, there's actually a section there just for, where is it?
That's true.
Yeah, and Quantum Link Reloaded.
There is.
Yeah.
So, there hasn't been any activity, has there, since in quite a while?
That's what I'm saying. The activity's died way down. I don't know if the server's still up, but definitely it's been quiet.
That's a shame, because I remember trying it, and I always intended to try to really get in there and, you know, check it out some more, and then I just haven't, and...
It's pretty neat. Another thing, Earl, I was going to say, I really enjoyed your interview with Stuart Chaffee. That was a while back. It was pretty neat because I know a lot of our stuff we like to find and research and look at is on, you know, Computer Chronicles, you know, on archive.org. And to actually hear, you know, Stuart talk, you know, years later about the show and how it got started was really great to hear. So thank you.
It was excellent. I saved that two-parter there.
Thank you, guys. I got to say, it was a lot of fun just chatting with him. He's such a nice fella and, you know, very intriguing to talk to, and also, of course, very well-spoken because he was a host himself of a very famous show for so many years that, you know, having him across the table, it didn't require any prodding or, you know, anything like that. It was a very natural flowing conversation. So, yeah, thanks. I really enjoyed that interview.
Where does he live?
I think in California. I think in the Bay Area.
Okay. Yeah.
I say, Evan, he'd make a good speaker, huh, or guest. So just talk about me. A new feature. I talk about myself a little bit. But I've been going through every Mac that I have, and I finally, my office I'm sitting in is a total disaster because I moved the tables out to the garage. So that's the good news, is the garage is all cleaned up and I have a work area. It's warming up here in the Atlanta area, so it's nice for that. So now I'm like going through all my old Macs and just trying to clean things up and create a nice work area. So that's been fun. I recently launched, I discussed this in the last show, been trying to launch a local user group, or essentially launch what Evan and March is in this area. So currently it's called the Historical Computer Society, based on a name I came up with years ago. We may change that. But so that went well. There's two guys involved that are very dedicated, and I think that's a huge start. Also, Evan, you might have saw in my notes here, you know, I interviewed Salem on the 5th, and it went pretty long, and it was very interesting. We got off on some other tangents that weren't computer history related, which is very interesting, slightly political. And
yeah,
so
you do know him.
Yeah, I know him much better now.
Yes, I bet.
And a great, great interview. And so, you know, I'm going to break that into two parts and start working on that as soon as I can. So that was fun and interesting. I've got an interview lined up with Jason Scott soon. Had to push it back. I'm so behind on everything. You know, the good news is this show has been very regular, and I want to keep it that way. Even though sometimes it takes me a few days to edit it, you know, every 3 weeks this show gets done. And so I've been real happy with that. But I just want to make another announcement. So the Historical Computer Society, we're going to do kind of our first event, if you will. It's on Saturday, March 12th. And it's at a regional school science fair. So there's a link, and I'll put it in the show notes, called the Georgia Educational Technology Fair. But anyway, so I've been given a space, and I'll bring as many old computers and other things to show. So that's
a great thing. We did an event a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago, time flies. It was called the New Jersey Science and Engineering Festival, and it was just at a local high school. And it was good because it was all families.
Yeah.
People who might not otherwise come to a computer history event. And they had, you know, one group there from the local dinosaur museum and one group from the zoo and everything else. And there was us. And it really was a really great way to show people that our hobby exists.
It mm-hmm. seems like that hooking up with other things like that are going on probably gets more people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to it, whether or not it's in Macon, which – you know, I live in north of Atlanta, about 30 miles of, you know, midtown, middle of Atlanta. So from my house, this high school it's held at is 100 miles away. But then there are people, you know, it's regional, so there's people all over the greater Atlanta area. So whether or not we get any active, you know, adults or hey, kids for that matter, that want to join the group, that'd be nice that happens. But I'm not, you know, it's just nice to show people stuff.
You also, you know, may do what we experienced was we got more people who said, well, I'm not really interested in this, but, you know, come clean out my garage and stuff.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Which we never turned down, so.
Well, and in my case, you know, I get to clean out my garage of stuff a little bit to take it there and show it off instead of it sitting in a garage, you know.
Awesome.
Okay, well, let's get at some of the news of interest here, items of interest in our news. So the first item is the passing of Ken Olson, who is the founder of DEC, and DEC, of course, being, you know, Digital Equipment Corporation, or Digital. I guess it kind of has always had three names. So he was 84 years old. He founded Digital in – they were a Massachusetts company, right?
Yes.
Evan, maybe you can speak to this.
Oh, okay. They were in Maynard, Mass, in a building called The Mill. It was an old mill. And it was in Metro Boston. And they were the company that really got started on the Boston Route 128 tech corridor, which is kind of like, you know, 101 out in Silicon Valley. And there was Data General and Wang and mm-hmm. DEC and MIT Lincoln Labs and a bunch of other companies as well that were all in that corridor for a while. Of course, they had, you know, a lot of MIT connections over the years, a lot of, you know, Army DARPA connections over the years. Data General was a spinoff, I believe. Of course, by the time they got to the PDP-8 era, 1965, that was the first commercial minicomputer, not the first minicomputer. There were other, you know, smaller military and, you know, experimental things. But in my opinion, what made DEC popular was it was their computers, especially with the 8 era and beyond, that made computing more accessible to a whole new generation of smaller companies. Before them, you had to be a company of a certain size and certain scale to get a computer. With the 8 generation and beyond, you could be a whole exponent smaller and still have access to a computer. Mm-hmm. So that's your legacy, in my opinion. And of course, today, DEC is one of the most popular companies among collectors. For a while, I think they were the second biggest computer company in the world, right? They had 120,000 employees around the world, second only to IBM. And just like, you know, Microsoft missed the internet revolution, they got in too little too late. DEC did that to the PC revolution, the microcomputer revolution. They had too little too late. And by the time they were in, you know, other companies took over already. Apple, you know, Commodore.
Right.
Even Microsoft.
They pretty much dominated the mini computer
right.
market, you know, that they kind of right. partly invented. And
it's interesting that they don't get a lot of play in computer history. I mean, what I would call mainstream computer history. You know, you don't hear much about them for as important as they were. I think it's probably difficult to overstate their significance in computer history. But, you know, history is always written by the victors, right? So
well, DEC was no loser, though. I mean, DEC was the second biggest company in the world.
But, right. That's what I'm saying.
So it's not like they were an afterthought. I've noticed on the academic side of computer history, there has been some. There was a book a couple years ago called DEC is Dead, Long Live DEC.
I haven't read that. That'd be a good read, it sounds like.
It was a pretty good read. It was not a light read by any means, but it was a read. And a lot of times I see interesting history as part of other histories. They show up a lot in the histories of the PC era. Whenever you read about a book about Bill Gates or a book about Xerox or whatever else, DEC's always a part of that. Stephen Levy's Hackers, DEC was a big part of it.
Right. I think maybe what happened too is that obviously in the mainstream or anything, non-academics, is that obviously computer history is mostly focused on personal computer history, which DEC didn't really become a player, versus IBM did. And so therefore it kind of automatically connected them to their previous history of being the big mainframe dominator.
Yeah, a lot of times you see, you know, dummy down computer history where it goes Babbage, ENIAC, IBM, Altair, and Microsoft, as if that's all there was, you know, and it didn't just go from mainframes to homebrews. It was, you know, but a lot of the mainstream history is naturally focused on, you know, military, business, personal, and it skips over that whole 70s transitionary generation.
I remember reading some about the PDP where there were installations in schools, you know, high schools and some colleges where a lot of kids, you know, that's where they got started and it inspired them to move on into the next kind of generation.
Well, Bill Gates, I cut my teeth on the PDP 11 in college.
Yeah, so I forget which model, but I mean Gates and Paul Allen. Yeah. That's exactly how they got started.
Right.
I think that was the PDP 10, wasn't it? Because
probably, yeah.
Allen later on, I mean, he's got, you know, the whole PDP site that he does. I can't remember the name of it, right? PDP Planet, I think it is.
Right.
He's got a large collection.
Yeah, that's right. And then isn't, even though DOS is constantly, you know, referred to as a ripoff of CPM, but wasn't CPM also essentially a copy of the TOPS? Isn't that a DEC operating system? TOPS 10 or?
I don't know about that. I can tell you, though, that a lot of DEC expertise and technology in that went into Windows NT, which is one of the, you know, lesser known, but the progeny of Windows NT, you know, ties a lot back to DEC. And
another example, I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Another example of how DEC technology is still with us today. DEC was acquired by Compaq, of course.
Yeah.
And Compaq was acquired by Hewlett Packard. And there was several high-level people at, you know, the whole storage works. I mean, I don't know if a lot of mainstream end users of technology know about, you know, SANs and, you know, storage works and whatnot, but storage works and VMS and everything, I mean, are still with us today in many ways. A lot of Compaq people got hired by EMC, which had already bought Data General, which was also a DEC spinoff. So a lot of that technology and the way of – a lot of the philosophy – of enterprise storage, enterprise servers are still with us in companies like EMC today.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
The only item that really I came encounter with DEC was the Alpha processor.
Yes.
And we had a server, and I worked at a ISP, and we did have a server running NT4 with the Alpha processor, and it was pretty good.
I was going to say, I remember the Alpha coming on really big in the late 90s, and I was really rooting for, you know, DEC with that. because we had an installation where I worked with all running Windows NT.
Yeah, I mean, just like today, you have like, you know, for Windows 2003 server, you know, you have an x86 version and an x64 version. Well, back then with NT, there was always an alpha version, you know, of the software and the patches and everything. So they really, you know, catered towards that processor for a while.
Yeah, and it also was just... on the hobby side of it, you know, a lot of newcomers to the hobby will find the Vintage Computer Forum. But a lot of us old timers, you know, found CC Talk. And when CC Talk was formed, I guess in 97 or so, before my time there, it was basically a deck list, right? I mean, didn't it came out of alt.folklore, also came out of the deck user groups, the Usenet groups. So, you know, that's very much was a deck group to start with, and it's still pretty strong tie-ins today.
Yeah. Well, in the article, so it's a short article at CNET, and there's lots of other articles out there about Ken Olson's passing and his history, but it mentions that DEC's decline in the early 1990s came as many computers were squeezed out by powerful Unix and RISC servers and eaten away by the low-end PCs. And then it talks about, you know, unfortunately, one of the most famous things he's known for is having made a statement that there is no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home.
What year did he allegedly say that?
If you look, there's a link to the Snopes article, 1977.
It's very, very important for people to understand that he wasn't talking about micros. He was talking about you know, what he grew up with. So.
Mini computers.
Yeah, so if you look at the Snopes article, it says, you know, near the kind of middle there, it says, there is no question that Ken Olson did indeed say the words history now attributes to him during a talk at a 1977 meeting of the World Future Society in Boston. But then to skip ahead a little bit, it says the quote-unquote computer Ken Olson was referring to and eschewing... Eschewing, is that I'm saying that right? Eschewing?
And eschewing.
Eschewing. As a home consumer product in 1977 was not the modern PC, a desktop user-driven device many of us use to play games, send and receive emails, so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's kind of an unfair connection, because especially even now in the last 10 years or more, the way people use computers now, it's an information device or a communication device / information device.
You could even imagine somebody saying today, there is no reason for anyone to need more than 6 computers in their home.
Right.
I mean, seriously, many of us may have, if you add them all up, our laptops and our iPads, some of us may have 6 computers or more in our home.
Yeah, I do.
Not that uncommon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't, well, I don't mean just our collection.
I have 3 children, so all 5 of us have a computer. And then we have a Mac Mini in the living room. And then that's not even counting, you know, obviously, forget about my collection of computers. We don't count those.
And it's also not counting your BlackBerry and your iPhone, those computers.
Right.
You know, whatever laptop you have for work, you know.
And, you know, that Snopes article that you talked about, David, it talks heavily about context. Mm-hmm. It says, you know, you can take this statement and you can examine it in isolation, but that's not really fair. You got to look at it like Evan was saying in the context that he was making that statement. Is, you know, if you could just imagine, Evan, I know that you've got at least one PDP-8 there in the collection. And could you imagine, I mean, in the 70s, having one of those things in your house? I mean, why would you want to do that?
Right.
Exactly. So, and by the way, as of last week, we now have 2 PDP-8s.
Awesome.
I'll talk more about that later.
What is it? The one you recently got? It's a straight 8, right? The what it's called?
The first one we have is a straight 8. Yeah, we got an 8E the other day.
And a straight 8 is it has the big sort of cabinet up on top where the two sides.
Well, that was the
up.
Desktop version. That's the one we have. There was also a rack mount version.
Okay.
And there were only about 1,500 made. I asked Gordon Bell and I asked some other people, you know, how many exist today, and no one knows. It's also complicated by the fact that many of the desktop ones were converted to the rack mount. So it's really hard to say how many still exist, but very, very few.
And just since I spoke to Salem recently, you know, he did that reproduction of one.
That's correct.
Pretty interesting if you go over to vintage.org and look at, I guess I'll have to put a link in the show notes now. But anyway, it's pretty interesting to see the reproduction he made, you know, compared to the real one. All right, well, very interesting. And especially the Snopes. I mean, both articles are really interesting to read, and I think especially the Snopes. And it has some quotes by Ken, you know, even up to 2003, him responding. I guess he got hammered for that one comment, you know, over and over the years. Well, next, turning to an item of interest is I wanted to bring up a gentleman named Jerry Lawson. February being Black History Month, I thought it was especially appropriate. He was a black video game pioneer, and there's a great article here written by Benji Edwards at Vintage Computing and Gaming, vintagecomputing.com. Me and my wife went to Vintage Computer Festival in California in 06 and actually met him. So there's a couple other links to YouTube videos. And we had a brief conversation with him and talked to him about the system that he created and designed called the Fairchild Channel F. And I wasn't familiar with it. And so, unfortunately, I almost felt bad that I didn't have as much to talk to him about. But are any of you familiar with this game system or played with it?
Yeah, yeah. It was not that popular, but I mean, wasn't it just around the same time or just slightly after the Mad Vox Odyssey?
I think so. I believe it's 72. Is that right? Let's see if there's a link to it.
Was it before the Odyssey? That can't be right.
Oh, no, 76.
I think it's after the Odyssey. Yeah. After the Odyssey, before the 2600.
It was released in August 76 at the retail price of $169.95.
It wasn't there some connection to Sears as well?
Magnavox.
I could be thinking of Atari. I'm not
sure. Sears had Atari connections.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the amazing thing about this guy is this Fairchild system. I was just reading through the article. This was the first cartridge-based, ROM-based, you know, ROM-based cartridge system, and that's huge. And he basically, you know, helped design that. This one guy, you know, for now, I mean, generations later, you know, it's everything is, you know, well, for you know, the 80s and 90s was all cartridges. So I mean, he was like the first guy, you know, to do this. So it's pretty amazing.
I wanted to quote something from the article about Jerry, which not to focus too much on the man's race. I mean, but obviously, you know, I brought up it's Black History Month. He's a black man. But it does kind of raise or make an interesting point. In the second paragraph, he says, he was looking through an 83 issue of Popular Computing. I encountered a photo that stopped me dead in my tracks. There I discovered among a story on a new computer business, a picture of a black man. It might seem crazy, but after reading through hundreds of issues of dozens of publications spanning four decades, it was the first time I had ever seen a photograph of a black professional in a computer magazine. Frankly, it shocked me, not because a black man was there, but because I had never noticed his absence. So?
I mean, it's rare, but I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, two of my best friends that I work with are in a past job are black guys, you know, and they're, you know, brilliant. I mean, they're just, and it's not to say it doesn't matter what race you come from. I think just in our industry, you don't see a lot of African Americans, you know, in technology or IT. It depends on really where you live, though. Like in Chicago, just like normal. It doesn't even faze me.
Well, I live in Atlanta.
Yeah. And I'm basically in New York, so yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, I think
one thing
context,
that always surprises me is, like I've never noticed it either because I'm in New York. You know, we have everybody out here, but I've never met a computer guy who was racist. Ever. And yeah. I think one reason, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I think one reason is, you know, we all grew up as, you know, science fiction nerds, right?
You know, I was just thinking that.
We all grew up accepting Chewbacca and R2-D2
and
all
Trek.
These blackout alien guys and Spock and everything else as equals.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Hell, I mean, who cares, you know, if I can accept a robot or a spaceman or whatever else or a Wookiee or anything else. You know, if you're black, Jewish, Islam, gay, you're my species.
Yeah. Well, we're all bound by one thing in technology. You know, I mean that's our passion, our interest. It doesn't matter what race you are.
What I was going for was more that, you know, if we could accept people from other planets and robots as equals, who cares what color or sexual preference or really, you know, you're human. You're my species, for God's sakes. You know, never mind. So why is it okay for R2-D2 or Chewbacca to be equal? But I have a problem with you.
Evan, that brings up the topic. I don't know if I believe Data should actually have equal rights.
Now, as you know, David, that was settled.
Yeah.
In that trial.
Oh, my God.
Don't make me go back and name the exact episode, but it's called The Measure of a Man. And if I remember season 2.
And I'm sorry to bring it up,
I do think it's very becoming of our hobby.
A real pet peeve of mine, Earl, that episode, because one of the arguments that number one, you know, was forced to be the
bad guy.
Yeah, not the defender, but the prosecutor, as he tried to make the point that the Enterprise's computer, Anyway, I'll keep this short, but you know, that it does what it's told and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there, when I remember the first time watching this going, the Enterprise's computer isn't a Starfleet officer. The moment you gave the guy a uniform and swore him into Starfleet, he became a, you know, like a person status.
But that's an interesting argument, and they didn't actually talk about that.
No, right. Here he sits in a Starfleet uniform with a grade, you know, an officer and so on. So once you gave him that, then how can you argue now that he doesn't have rights as any other Starfleet officer?
Wow.
Yeah, they never touched on that.
Anyway,
it's a TV show.
I think it's very becoming of our hobby that race is and gender and preference is not an issue.
I agree, Evan.
We're all just computer nerds, and that's – and also age. I mean, if you look at the general IT field, ageism is a big issue, especially now. But in our hobby, I know people who are 16 and people who are 65, and we're all equals as long as you're good.
I agree. It's a very positive thing too.
I mean, and also, I mean, look at Jerry Ellsworth, right? Jerry is a high school dropout, and the fact obviously she's a she. And she's young, and she got just, you know, she's hanging out with Lee Felsenstein. So, it's, you know, all that matters is merit.
Yeah.
And just to put this article just in more context, too, I think, you know, he was looking at a 1983 copy of a magazine. So things have changed even quite a bit since then. That to look back on people involved in the industry from a more historical perspective, I think maybe that's what, you know, why you didn't see black faces very much. It's pretty much dominated white men, like most things have been, you know, in a lot of industries and corporate and so on. So,
yeah, I think that's what's probably stands out about him is that he was an early, you know, mid-70s, you know, programmer, you know, that really made a big deal. It was a big deal because being the first cartridge-based system, ROM-based, I mean, that set a standard for years to come. So he's pretty important in that field.
So in the show notes, there's also there's an article about Jerry. There's a Wikipedia article about the Fairchild Channel F. I think these are both two very interesting videos at Google Video. So some quick interviews with him. And
he's pretty funny, too.
Yeah. And so the gentleman's name is James Payton, who sent me those links. And so he's a listener. And thanks a lot, James. And he's the guy talking to him off camera, at least in one of those. So I think it's the one on the show floor. Is the one him talking to him. So next we have an article that was features Evan, our own Evan Koblitz. And what is this too? It's Minionville.
Okay, here's the deal. I never heard of that site before they called me. Apparently it's a website, kind of a hip alternative to the establishment or investment websites, or so I'm told. I never heard of it. I asked the reporter where they got the name from. Like, what the heck is Minionville? And she's like, I just work here. Okay. So, I mean, I've spent the last 14 years covering technology as a reporter. And when I have a trend article, you know, first I discover that a trend does exist and then I go report on it. She called me with the opinion that the trend exists. You know, she seemed to want to have facts to back up her theory. You know, she said she was doing a series on alternative investments and she picked vintage computers. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm like, no one really does it for that purpose. But she had her heart set on that hypothesis. So I thought, well, if she's going to interview somebody, it might as well be me anyway, you know, as opposed to somebody else. So I took the Free Press. But I thought I was just being quoted. I didn't know the article was going to be like all about Evan. I didn't expect that at all. But anyway, I tried to answer the questions the best I can about what's a decent investment in this hobby. And I also tried to emphasize that unlike some other investments, you can't just buy it and put it in a garage and it'll be worth $1 million in 30 years. I emphasize that you have to be a technology person and know how to maintain these things or else it'll go to heck, you know? And I think that got through.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to emphasize, you know, it's hard to do if you're looking for investments because you have to have two different skill sets. You have to have money and investment knowledge, and you have to be a really hardcore technology person. I don't know how many people have both of those things. So I tried to dissuade them from the opinion that, you know, I tried to what's the word?
Dissuade?
Disprove?
Not disprove.
Debunk?
it'll come to me. Disabuse them of the notion that people do our hobby for the money. And I don't really – she seemed to have a heart set on writing about that. So anyway, we got some good Free Press out of it, so I'm not complaining.
And I noticed –
At least not to the general public.
Yeah, it brings up the topic where, you know, you're quoted about, you know, what qualifies as vintage, and you use the 10-year rule, which 10-year rule, I guess originally that
I did not use that rule. I was trying to explain to them how was trying to tell them, if anyone hears this, don't take it seriously. That's not the case anymore.
Right. Because that was kind of originally started with the CC list, I guess, in 97 sort of initially.
Yeah, I am an enemy of the 10-year rule.
Okay. Well, yeah, what now? Because it would – I was going to say 10 years ago is 2001. So
exactly.
15 years ago is 1996, and
don't even get me started. I'm an avowed enemy of the 10-year rule. I'm an avowed enemy of chronological rules. I think whether we extend it to 15 or 20 is ridiculous. I think it should be a context rule, not a chronological rule.
And it can be relevance and rarity as well, and uniqueness
even. I don't even want to talk about that. It makes me mad. it was nice to get the free press for our hobby and VCF and everything else. I'm mildly concerned that people will read the article and contact me and think, okay, good, Evan's a guy I can sell all my stuff to. He'll pay me big bucks for my crap.
Yeah.
So I was hoping they would write in there that March only accepts donations, which, you know, but that hasn't happened yet, so we'll see.
Have you been contacted by anyone from the
Nobody yet.
And then,
well, also, I guess I'd be a little apprehensive that they would think of vintage computing as a viable investment vehicle. I can think of, you know, probably four or five reasons why it would be a dubious choice to actually invest hard dollars in vintage computing and believe that you were going to make a decent return on your investment.
Oh, yeah, it would be nuts. You know, maybe I should have said that, but I held my tongue a little bit because I figured since they had their heart set on writing that story, if they're going to talk to me or somebody else, so it might as well be me.
Sure.
I don't know how they found me. They happened to call me first. I said, okay, well, if you're going to write it anyway, then I'll take it. But I didn't really.
Like, if you come upon an Altair at a flea market, regardless of what, you know, within reason of what condition it's in, and it's $20, that's a good investment. Doesn't have to work. I mean, even if you got on the low end $500 for it, well, you have made some money.
Right. And so, I did tell one story that you printed about an IBM Simon I bought for $100 and something a few years ago and sold a few years later to $5,000. But that was a fluke. You can't count on that.
Wow, you sold it for $5,000?
Yeah. It's as you guys know, I'm into portables and handhelds and stuff. 3 or 4 years ago, I bought an IBM Simon new in box on eBay for $170 or whatever it was. And a couple of years later, a billionaire in Silicon Valley who I cannot and will not name contacted me and said, hey, I need one. I'll give you a big chunk of money for it. And I said, what's your idea for a big chunk of money? And if he had said $500, I would have been like, sold. He said $5,000.
Can you give us a hint who it was?
I really can't. I promised the man to protect
him. I'm just kidding.
I mean, there's a few things that you can find. You know, like you said, finding them at flea markets, yard sales, stuff like that. I mean, I have some classic games from, you know, when I was young that now they may be like $80 or something.
Oh, yeah. I'd say the gaming market has just exploded, in fact.
People want the original discs, original manuals, you know, like it's some of the Ultima games, and they're very hard to find. And, you know, they went up a little bit, but it's, you know, it's not much, you know.
Yeah. And I think the person who contacted me was inspired by that Christie's auction, the Apple One.
Yeah,
and it was also a thing a few months before that with Nintendo, where some cartridge went for like $100,000, whatever it was.
Right, $30,000, I think.
Now that I will say, I know a little bit about that with the classic of video game collecting, and I sort of got into that back in college. It was, I think, around 96, 97, and I began to really hunt for, you know, Atari 2600, ColecoVision, old video game systems and games. And I think one time I was at a flea market and I got a box of about 75 games for like $25. You know, the guy just cleaning out their garage. And, I found a few rare ones on there, sold them on eBay. And so that kind of got it started. But there are games. There's a lot of Nintendo games that are, prototypes or very rare. And they do sell for big bucks.
Yeah. But I can't imagine people who spend time reading investment websites or going to flea markets looking for used video games.
Exactly.
But there's always a small amount of people that go and look for all kinds of wild stuff, because there is always a small market. And if you get the right thing, it's worth something.
I thought the story was kind of ridiculous, but I took it for what it was. So
you can make more money investing in mutual funds. I mean, it's this is not an investment hobby, really.
So let's see. Let's move on. The next item we're going to discuss is the Watson, I guess it's supercomputer that is that still airing, by the way? You know, I haven't watched it. I watched some of it on YouTube, and I've read about it. Was it on there like over a few days? Is that right?
It was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this week.
Did you guys watch the actual show at all?
I watched the first day and it ended in a tie.
Well, so I mentioned it. I listed it because it's kind of interesting. It's not specifically computer history related. It does kind of link back to another IBM project or supercomputer called Deep Blue, which beat the chess master Garry Kasparov. So at 13 years ago, what was that, 1998?
Something like that.
So that's not even that long ago, is it?
No, but I mean, computers have been playing a very serviceable game of chess for a long time. Right. I mean, there were chess programs in the 80s. I'm a real pedestrian chess player, but they would clean my clock easily on the lowest level. And, you know, I think this is from a historical perspective, computers versus people in gaming has been going on for a long time.
Right. In fact, at the Computer History Museum in California, long before they opened their new Revolution exhibit, one of their first exhibits several years ago was History of Computer Chess.
Ah.
Oh, okay. I think one thing that fascinates me about Watson from what I've seen is we discussed this a little bit, you know, before the show, and Evan, you talked about, you know, you weren't that impressed with it. It's essentially just a huge database and it's cross-referencing things, which is true. And that's kind of not that impressive because Google's pretty fast too when you do a search. But I think the AI part of it, where it's recognizing voice, you know, voice recognition, and then it's of course doing a level of AI where it's talking back, giving the answers.
Right. Well, something else that I thought was very unfair is that they had an electron, you know, at some point they had a solenoid which physically hit the buzzer, because mm-hmm. It had the same buzzer in its, you know, quote unquote hand as the human players. But obviously this, you know, the electronic pulse that says hit solenoid now can work faster than the human brain, you know, hand-eye coordination. And I think that was really unfair because even if the humans came up with the same answer at the same time,
they couldn't get in there.
Literally could not answer as fast.
I had wondered about that.
I saw an interview with Jennings or whatever his name was, the other human there. Mm-hmm. And he said part of the strategy in Real Jeopardy against humans is not who thinks the answer first, it's who can answer it first, who can spit it out first. And I think they really ought to handicap Watson to make its ability to hit the buzzer as slow as the fastest humans. Because I think at that point, it really was unfair because that's beyond the human physical limits, not the human mental limits.
Yeah, I kind of wondered, like I said, how did they handle that, to make that where it could in any way be fair. But another thing I wanted to bring up about it is, one of my favorite documentaries is called The Machine That Changed the World. I've brought it up numerous times. You can see that on Top Documentaries. I have links to it in other shows. I guess I'll have to link to it this time. But there's a whole section about AI and the history of AI and sort of how it was really hyped up there. I guess is Marvin Minsky, isn't he? He was one of the key guys in that. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess, early 60s, is that right? But it sort of failed. You know, all the predictions of the advancement of it, you know, in just 10 years we'll have this or something. Ultimately, it was just was, you know, never happened. So here we are in 2011, and this is a fairly impressive.
Well, it happened, but it's behind the scenes. I mean, mm-hmm. AI happens every day at the stock market and Google and everything. AI is happening, you know, 24/7 behind the scenes every day of our lives. It's just not real sexy. It's not robots, it's not C-3PO. But, you know, robots, I mean, you know, run around car factories all day long and no one thinks twice about it. But it's just not it's not as in our face as we would have thought.
Well, I guess in the sense of Watson here.
But it exists. It's real.
Can it pass the Turing test? Which it can't, I don't think. The answer is that, no, you couldn't have a true conversation with it. But it made me think about these things, the Turing test, the possibilities of, that would almost make it more interesting special versus just playing Jeopardy, is they work on it, do something like that, and have conversations, have people challenge it and do the Turing test.
Right. And as we said before the show started, some of its answers were hilariously wrong. Can't say that word. Comically wrong.
Failed a final Jeopardy with a totally goofy answer.
Yeah, the question was about U.S. dates, and it said Toronto.
Yeah.
And you could see the IBM engineers like cracking up and putting their heads in their hands off to the side. You know?
Oh, that I wonder what Carrington would have to say if he hears that we annex Toronto.
They could have Wisconsin. We'll trade.
Oh boy.
I'll keep my politics.
For our Wisconsin listeners, that's Edmund.
Yeah, here comes your hate mail, David.
In care of Marge. So let's discuss real quickly this painting and some of these last few items we can just kind of cover. We don't have to discuss it too much. But so an original painting of the Castle Wolfenstein cover art for the Apple II. That, were you following this, Matt?
No, I hadn't heard about this, but I guess this is the guy who actually painted the box art. You said the box art is for the Apple II version?
I think, well, that looks like, okay, they also had a DOS version, an Atari 8-bit, and Commodore 64. So I was mostly familiar with it being big on Apple II. But it's from Muses Software's 1981 game Castle Wolfenstein, which, was, of course, was the, id went on to make the Wolfenstein 3D, a different company.
Yeah, I mean, it's an original piece of art. So if it's originals, obviously sell for a lot. So there's going to be a market for people out there that are into, game history that would pay this much for an original piece. So
I guess I was surprised, $2,024.
Yeah.
I was surprised with that.
I'm going to say the opposite. As we all know, gaming is a much bigger hobby than vintage computing. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised it sold for so little. Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything about the original artwork, or whatever. But if it really was like the original one, as opposed to one of the original ones or something, then I would have thought it might have gone for more than that.
I mean, art's going to be expensive. I mean, I know that. My uncle has he has a Thomas Kincaid gallery. I don't know if you guys know of Thomas Kincaid, mm-hmm. but he has canvases that sell for $20,000, $30,000. And it's not. I mean, people know about him, but not a lot. It's very regional. It's mainly a southern type of artist, but $2,000. Yeah, you're probably right. It could have gone for a lot more.
And I think I believe that this painting will retain its value. It's a significant game, so it can only be worth more in the future. How much more, I don't know. Just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if it was an original painting of Mario or Pac-Man or something. You would think it would go for a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you remember this sort of stuff. The Atari 2600 games, I mean, there was an article not too long ago talking about how you'd have this box with this wonderful looking artwork on the front, and then you'd play the game and it's just a few pixels running around.
I know. I remember this for my birthday in Hanukkah as a kid, and you think, wow, it looks like that. Cool. Really realistic race cars. You open it up, it's like two little blocks.
But if you could imagine having some of the original artwork from those.
Yeah, and those are
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful.
And speaking of, I know Jason Scott's name came up, and the artwork for GitLamp is done in that very style.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm trying to think, there's another company that makes stuff for the Macintosh, and they also have done some, they did like some retro-looking boxes that were totally done in the style of those Atari boxes and Activision boxes, and maybe it'll come to me, and I can, I'll put the link in the show notes, but it's pretty neat. I like that kind of, that style.
Yeah.
Well, there was a mention from, Evan, you remember, what's the name of the discussion list for that?
Systs. I think it was on Systs. For people who don't know what that is, but I think it's probably most people. There's a group called the Society for the History of Technology. It is purely an academic history group. It's not really for hobbyists. Anyway, they have a million lists, like all groups do, and somebody posted this link. At least I think that's where it was. And basically, this was some guy's PhD thesis about the history of election night forecasting using computers, which is, of mild interest to hobbyists. But what was interesting in it to me, anyway, was that a lot of the part of the thesis that led up to the political discussion was about the companies themselves, and companies like I mentioned earlier before the show, a company called Monrobot, which is the computer division of Monroe Calculator here in New Jersey. And I read that, and we were looking. This just sorry to go off topic here, David, but if I may just real quickly, we're always looking for new guest speakers for our VCF East here in New Jersey. And there's, you know, a much more finite pool than there is in California, obviously. So it occurred to me, I said, hey, you know, wait, this company, Monroe Calculator, was a big important computer company in the 50s. They were here in Jersey. I wonder if I can find any of those guys. So I contacted the author, this man, Ira, who wrote the paper, and he contacted some people on my behalf who got back to me and said, yes, we'll do a lecture. So it worked out pretty well. But if anyone's just interested in computer, you know, electronic voting, it's very interesting for that, as was its original purpose. And it's available free to anyone to read online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's the link will be in the show notes. And basically the link is a direct, just a download link to a PDF. The document is, 588 pages. So it's extremely detailed. And, you know, yeah, very academic. I haven't read it.
It is a PhD thesis. It's
not
for the public.
So essentially, it talks about, and what it's talking about is, I'm trying to get to someplace I can, election night 1952, and there you can easily find some video of this on YouTube, and I guess I'll try to find that. A link to that might be helpful. CBS used a UNIVAC computer as a publicity, you know, which UNIVAC is more than happy to, you know, have them do that for publicity, and it forecasted the winner of the 1952 election as Eisenhower.
Right, and then the famous
and the landslide, and they didn't believe it.
Right.
Go ahead, Evan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were already going there. I apologize. They didn't believe it, so they actually held the results for a while until reality proved that the computer was right. And they said, hey, audience, you know, you're not going to believe this, but turns out our computer guessed it, and we held the results. We didn't think it was right, but it was.
That's funny.
It would be like, imagine if they had, you know, a computer predicting the Super Bowl and it guessed a winner after the first two plays of the game, and they said, nah, how could I possibly know? And by the third quarter, they proved right. And they, you know, it'd be that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it'll be even more amazing because today that wouldn't really surprise you. 1952, you know.
Right.
Amazing.
But it's a very interesting piece. I mean, so, like I said, I'll find the YouTube video of it and link to that, which will probably be – I know I've watched it before. It'll be a few minutes long, and so that's worth checking out. I think that – I'm trying to think that the reporter was – I believe his last name was Collinsworth, very well-known, you know, reporter.
Wasn't it Edward R. Murrow?
Could have been, but let's look it up.
Chris Collinsworth is an NFL reporter.
You're right, Chris Collinsworth for.
I quickly looked. I couldn't seem to find the video on YouTube, but it may take a little digging.
Nah, it's got to be there.
UNIVAC won. Okay, let's see here. The 1952 presidential election, with a sample of just 1% of the voting population, it correctly predicted that Dwight Eisenhower would win, and they didn't believe it. Let's see if it links off.
You know, it's interesting, though. I wonder how easy it would have been for that to have gone the other way. I mean, if you think about it, who knows what heuristics they use to calculate who is going to win? I mean, it's all about the program, right? How did the program figure it out? And was that 1% a statistically valid sample based on precinct reporting? You know how complicated election reporting and prediction is. And it's part of the reason why I think the networks these days have taken, especially in presidential elections, that they're not going to make a prediction until the polls close, because that can have an effect on things. So I mean, I personally think it could have just as easily gotten it wrong as gotten it right.
But, there was certainly some luck involved. But there was a famous case, I think it was 1980, when they had John Anderson run as an independent, where a lot of networks on the East Coast announced, you know, results, and people on the West Coast said, well, my vote doesn't matter, so they didn't go vote.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the legal issues after the 2000 election.
Right.
Right.
Which has a computer history tie-in, if we can play 76 degrees of separation here. computer history tie-in, because the Hagen Chads, of course, were you know, that term came from punch cards.
Well, and actually, didn't that also bring a lot of attention to the percentage of sampling for them to predict things, too? If I'm right, in 2000?
Right. And like, I had a good laugh when, you know, Dave Letterman and everybody else thought Hagen Chads were a crazy new thing. Because, you know, anyone who used punch card machines in, you know, 1960 knew about hanging chats. So it was hard, definitely not a new phenomenon.
Well, so the last... This is the end of part one. Please turn your podcast over to side two.